Hello, I'm Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the IEA, and welcome to the Live from Lord North Street podcast. When it comes to environmental problems in general, and global warming in particular, general consensus is that something must be done. Greta Thunberg and Extinction Rebellion have become sensations. But what's worrying about this phenomenon is that the more detached from critical reason their arguments become, the more they are acclaimed. Greta, for example, began by arguing that those who put forward alternative views were liars and asserted that she had a special gift for being able to tell when people were lying. Her recent speech at the UN Climate Summit was simply a series of assertions. Extinction Rebellion seems to be strongly linked to far-left political movements. The left often argue that climate change cannot be solved by markets, and aren't hasty to be honest about the trade-offs involved. I've asked the IEA's Victoria Hewson, hello Victoria, who is Head of Regulatory Affairs, and the IEA's Head of Political Economy, Dr. Christian Niemitz. Hi Christian. To join me and discuss the trade-offs and challenges of adopting such a radical carbon-neutral prescription as espoused by Greta and Extinction Rebellion. So, Victoria, to start with you, the argument seems to be that we will have a sort of green jobs and green standard of living without any real hardship from reducing emissions. Is that right?
That certainly seems to be the argument. And I guess activists like Extinction Rebellion and other sort of political figures who put forward this idea of a Green New Deal seem to have this idea that if only government were to invest in green technologies, that would become the new source of people's jobs and the new source of growth, which seems a little bit fantastical to me, I must say. I'm just actually looking here. I received an email from the UN Commission for Trade and Development, and they at least seem to be acknowledging in what they say about a Green New Deal that it will mean resetting the whole rules of the economic order. And that's coming from a commission, an agency of the United Nations, which I think indicates just how prevalent this view is. However, to your question, at least they seem to be admitting that that would entail a complete rebuilding of the economic order as we know it, not simply tinkering around and investing in nice green things.
Christian, an American national survey has found that half, so 51%, of voters under 35 believe it is at least somewhat likely that humanity will be wiped out in the next decade or so. So won't these sort of calls just grow louder? Isn't it time to act now?
Well, we are acting now, and we have been acting for decades. One of the things I find bizarre about this movement is that they seem to think that it has never occurred to anyone before they came along to do something about climate change. I mean, I don't know when this started, but my own political memories go back until the late 90s, and it was definitely already a big issue then. Remember the discussions about the Kyoto Protocol in the early 2000s, and the first Renewable Energy Acts being passed around that time. So there has been a very high level of awareness of that issue for definitely 20 years, probably more than that, and a lot of policy consequences following from that. It's not the case that we're doing nothing about the issue. This is a new generation of activists. They probably don't have much of an active memory of that. For them, it's relatively new. They've only discovered the topic now, and they think nobody else has done that before them. But going back on this, are we going extinct? No, we're not. I mean, this isn't backed by anything. I think it was best summarized by Bjørn Lomborg, the Danish statistician, who said something like, yes, climate change is a problem. Yes, it is man-made. Yes, we should do something about it. But is it the end of the world? No.
And Victoria, do you agree that given the average income in the UK is 10 times the average income in the rest of the world, when other people face these trade-offs that you've spoke about, the sacrifice of decarbonisation is much greater for others than it is for the UK?
Yes, and I think this is one of the great ethical problems that seems to me to be under-acknowledged and under-discussed by especially the climate protesters from the left. Again, some of this is naivety. For example, they seem to think that developing countries can in order to develop and industrialize and improve their standards of living, can somehow leapfrog the phase of using fossil fuels that we in the West benefited from for our development and industrialization, and that countries like Kenya should build wind farms and solar farms mm-hmm. in order to progress. But quite frankly, that just isn't going to work. It's just not. Even aside from the fact that wind farms and solar farms come with environmental problems of their own, it's simply not realistic to expect that developing countries in Africa, for example, can increase their GDP and improve their living standards by using only renewable and green technologies. And this problem of the ethics of our own decarbonisation programme as well has impact on developing countries. For example, if we were to impose a carbon tax, which we might come on to in a moment, mm-hmm. for that to be genuinely workable across our economy, you would have to have some kind of border adjustment to prevent companies from simply outsourcing their carbon, manufacturing everything overseas in, say, China, and then importing it to sort of get around the carbon tax in this country. Now, in order to get to counter that risk, imposing an additional import tax on goods from countries that don't have equivalent decarbonisation regulations is actually going to penalise poorer countries who are in the process of industrialising. And I think that has some serious ethical problems that we aren't discussing enough.
I can see Christian itching to get in. We're going to come back to the carbon tax, if that's what you want to get in on.
No.
Okay.
No, I just wanted to add to that, of course, economic development is in itself the best way to become more resilient to environmental problems, whether they're caused by climate change or something else. We saw this a couple of years ago when there was a massive earthquake in Haiti, and it was an absolute calamity for them, killed literally hundreds of thousands of people. And at the same time, or roughly the same time, Chile had an earthquake of a similar magnitude. Of course, it was a big problem for them too, but it was much less of a catastrophe there than it was for Haiti. The reason is simply that Chile is now an upper middle income country, relatively highly developed, which means that they can cope with things that yes. a poor country can't. And the same is true for all sorts of environmental problems, whether they're climate related or not. And nobody is suggesting that even if we shut down all CO2 emissions overnight, that there would never be any environmental disasters, again, any natural disasters occurring. It's just about that might increase the likelihood. Mm-hmm. Climate change increases the likelihood of those events, but they will happen anyway at some frequency. And it's better to be rich, because that's the way you become resilient to it.
You can say that a bit again. Victoria, we've seen moves against things like even like air conditioning. Speaking of those matters of development, air conditioning leads to higher carbon emissions and most likely higher global temperatures. But the increase in resilience arising from air conditioning is actually quite astonishing if you look at the stats. It's led to an 80% drop in deaths from heat, and some are arguing that that's a trade-off worth making, because the science tells us that, I mean by getting rid of air conditioning, because the science tells us that we'll die in a ball of flames in a matter of 15 years or so if we don't make these changes, doesn't it?
Well, the science doesn't tell us that at all.
But I that's think. What Extinction Rebellion
well,
keep telling
they,
me.
They seem very keen to urge everyone to listen to the scientists, but they're not showing very much evidence that they are listening to and absorbing the actual science themselves. To the point about air conditioning, it's a great example of the kinds of trade-offs.
I did steal it from Professor Philip Booth, to clarify.
Well,
great point anyway.
Quoting Philip Booth is always a good idea. But not only actually does air conditioning improve, people's, I guess, resilience to surviving heat waves, it actually improves people's productivity massively, because you can work in cooler conditions. And so it has huge benefits, especially for people living in hotter countries, the global south, etc. And similar, you know, arguments to be made on things like vehicles. It's all very well for people in London to urge people to stop driving cars and use public transport, but when you live in a small town or in the countryside where there is no or very little public transport, that's not so easy. And, you know, with electric vehicles, for example, you have to think clearly down the line. Electric vehicles are good in the sense that they don't themselves produce emissions, but they do rely on electricity mm-hmm. being generated yeah. in order to power them. And I'm just not sure that there's much joined up thinking going on in this area as so many areas of this debate.
Now, Victoria mentioned we would come on to a carbon tax, and we have indeed reached that moment. Christian, some economists have proposed carbon taxes or carbon trading as the best way to reduce carbon emissions. People can then choose the most efficient way to reduce emissions whilst keeping those carbon-emitting technologies that are most valuable to them or which are most difficult to replace. Do you back a proposal like that?
Yes, well, that's the conventional Econ 101 textbook solution, either a carbon tax or a cap and trade scheme. They're not hugely different in practice, whether you tax carbon at a rate of whatever, £20 per ton, or whether you need a permit that costs £20 per ton, makes the same impact, has the same effect ultimately. And as you said, the main advantage of that is that it allows each individual and each individual firm to react to that increase in the cost of carbon in the way that they see fit and in the way that they can do it most easily. So we all engage in a number of carbon intensive activities, and we all have some of them that we really rely on or wouldn't want to live without, and others that are more optional, others where we might make adjustments and replacements and we don't mind it so much. So for example, if you slightly increase the cost of meat in this way, then somebody who really loves to go to the steakhouse would carry on doing that, whereas for somebody who is the marginal meat eater, who is more or less indifferent between meat and some low carbon alternative, would then switch to that low carbon alternative. But the point is that everybody reacts in the way to it that is least painful to them. You make the adjustments that you can most easily make without sacrificing much of your living standard, and that gets us around the problem that if the government picks particular technologies and says this is definitely the way we must reduce carbon, then the problem is it might turn out in a couple of years that some of those technologies were totally overhyped. It may now seem that renewable energy is the way to go. Maybe it is, but maybe we will in a couple of years find out that at least some of those forms of renewable energy are never going to cut it. And it could be very much like in the early days of social media, where you had some platforms around that that had a quick hype and then they died out and now nobody remembers them. And this can happen, of course, in the area of carbon abatement as well, that there might be some hype, some way of reducing carbon emissions that's popular with politicians and everyone thinks that's definitely the way to go. And then later we find out, actually, no, this was massively overstated. If you have a carbon tax, then you still have that market discovery process. If we then find out, okay, this is not the way to go, we need to do something else, market participants can do that. Whereas once you have a subsidy program in place, you're never going to get rid of it.
And Victoria, Christian's hit the nail on the head, really, hasn't he? Because government intervention in this sphere has led to things like burning so-called renewable wood pellets for biofuel and diesel cars.
Right, and that's exactly the point. In the energy market in inverted commas, at the moment in this country, it's barely a market at all anymore. Government intervention is dictating the source of supply, it's dictating capacity management, and now it's even dictating retail prices by way of the energy price cap. And it does this, as I say, by way of price caps, it does it by way of the capacity market reforms that have been brought in, and it does it by way of picking winners and subsidizing certain forms of energy generation, in particular wind power, by way of contracts for differences, etc., which all get passed down ultimately to the consumer. And there are many people who know a lot more about these things than I do who have serious reservations about the viability of some of these market interventions, in particular contracts for differences, and how that's all going to shape up as and when they start to kick in over the coming years. Now, the other intervention that you mentioned was the diesel regulations. I think it's often forgotten that the diesel scandal, whereby the EU regulations for emission standards on motor vehicles were actually initiated as part of the EU's decarbonisation agenda to encourage people to switch from petrol, which is relatively higher carbon output than diesel. Obviously, it was neglected at the time to notice that diesel is actually very, very bad in terms of air quality because it produces lots of nitrogen oxides. Coincidentally, of course, that intervention turned out to be extremely helpful for European automotive manufacturers. So this is a great example of how these, on the face of it, well-meaning interventions turn out to be extremely susceptible to manipulation by lobbying and vested interests. So we should be very, very careful in how we look at these well-meaning sort of things that Extinction Rebellion and others are campaigning for.
And Christian, the argument seems to be from these, and I mentioned in the introduction that they seem to be strongly linked to far-left political movements. And they're calling for central planning of the economy as the most rational mechanism for taking economic decisions to advance our, well, getting rid of our carbon emissions. But haven't centrally planned economies been absolutely catastrophic for environmental outcomes, just as they have been for all other aspects of economic welfare?
Yeah, sure. In Central and Eastern Europe, they're still cleaning up the environmental cost of socialism, the legacy cost from more than 30 years ago. Environmentalism and socialism should not be natural bedfellows, but in practice, they usually are. That's partly, I guess, just an expression of the socialist zeitgeist at the moment, that every movement that comes along immediately gets absorbed into this. We had the socialism hype before, then Extinction Rebellion came along, and within a couple of days you could see hammer and sickle flags and various other socialist symbols, and it just quickly got absorbed and co-opted by it and into it. There's the claim made in The Guardian pretty much on a daily basis that you cannot really solve the climate problem within capitalism. But this is complete nonsense. Carbon emissions are an unfortunate byproduct in the production of useful goods and services that people want and are prepared to pay for. So companies are not emitting CO2 because they want to wind up Guardian columnists. They're doing it because they're producing useful stuff, and this is a side effect of that. And this is something that occurs in any type of economy, whether that's a capitalist or a socialist or a mixed economy or something completely outside of that framework. You always have that trade-off that if you want to reduce carbon emissions or other forms of pollution, then that comes at an economic cost, and that's a trade-off that you have to make. That's true in any economic system, so it's completely irrelevant whether this is in a capitalist or socialist economy, and therefore that we're even talking about whether we should change the entire economic system is completely missing the point.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, that I imagine there's going to be a significant overlap between people who have campaigned over the years against austerity in inverted commas, and the people who are currently out on the streets calling for for us to embrace a hunter-gatherer lifestyle and revert to the kinds of lifestyle pursued by indigenous peoples, which I think is in the Extinction Rebellion manifesto. And this is all getting a very easy ride from people who have campaigned stringently against austerity. But the kind of austerity that Extinction Rebellion have in mind is actually almost beyond our comprehension. Mm-hmm. So there's some serious double standards going on, I think, there.
Well, absolutely. You lose your meat, you lose your car, you lose your holidays, you lose your job, you lose
right.
your...
Right, and I mean, even in a less extreme...
Gas heating.
Even in a less extreme version of this than what Extinction Rebellion have in mind, the government's own 2050 net zero target, I believe, was estimated by the Chancellor of the Exchequer to cost £1 trillion to achieve in basically in foregone... GDP, I think that was the cost of it. And that's really not irrelevant to people's lives and livelihoods.
Yeah, I think it was George Monbiot who first used the term austerity before it was used in the sense of fiscal consolidation, well before, where he was talking about his environmental agenda. And he said, yes, this isn't about raising living standards. This is about an austere lifestyle. So he came up with it first. He's the original champion of austerity. But it has to be, of course, the right kind of austerity.
Yeah. Now, I wonder if to end, and I'll start with Victoria, if the government call you up, and you're tasked with reducing the UK's carbon emissions and being an advocate for doing so around the world, what is it that you would be recommending? Would you be picking up Extinction Rebellion's manifesto and waving it proudly?
No, I'm not really a supporter of the Extinction Rebellion, what they presumptuously call demands. I'm afraid this is going to be quite a boring answer, because I agree with Christian here that the most effective way to do it, and the really only serious way to achieve these kinds of serious reductions in carbon emissions, is with an economy-wide carbon tax. Get rid of all of the piecemeal interventions and subsidies. Get rid of the, again, piecemeal current raft of levies, the emission trading scheme, plus the carbon floor price measures that we have in this country, and just do it properly.
Christian?
Yep, that's exactly right. It's a single objective that we have, which is reducing carbon emissions at in an efficient way, in a way that causes minimal economic harm. And if you just have one simple objective, you should only use one tool for that, which should be either a border-adjusted carbon tax or a carbon cap and trade system. And I'm relatively indifferent between those two, but given that we already have a cap and trade system, I would say build on that, use that. The price of a carbon permit is somewhere between 20 euro and 28 euro. That is not that far away with some of the estimates of the social cost of carbon that the economist William Nordhaus in particular has come up with, and which means that what we're doing right now is already broadly right. Mm-hmm. This emissions trading scheme is the only problem with it so far has been that it's been quite selective, doesn't cover all sectors. It could be broadened, could be made more consistent, but on the whole, I think it's not that bad. Something like that is the way to go.
Brilliant. Thank you both very much. Now, let me know what you thought of this podcast by tweeting us at IEA London. And you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is now that you get your podcasts. We're even on Spotify now. Thank you very much for listening.